Nobody covers dog sledding like Mushing from First Paw Media. Our team of athletes, volunteers, race organizers, and mushers like Robert and Michelle Forto brings you closer to the sport. If it's happening, we are there. Live from the qualifying races in January and February, the Iditarod in March, and in the summer, Mushing takes you on the road with our team and trail tour. We connect you with a history of the sport, in-depth interviews with the top mushers, and great storytelling and breaking news all year long. Follow on Mushing.com.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert, and you're listening to the Mushing Podcast. And tonight I am joined by a returning guest. His name is Tony Coughlin. He owns Endurance Kennels out of Duluth, Minnesota. Tony, how's it going today?
It's going good. The sun came out and dried things out today. Finally, I think we got our humidity down into the high 50s, high 60s. A little bit of wind, but too warm for harnesses, but we've been keeping the dogs moving with our free running program.
The mushing season is upon us. Just about everywhere in the world, I'm sure, are on their way to planning for the next season. I know it's cooling off a little bit up here in Alaska. The leaves have all changed and we're ready to rock and roll. As I mentioned, Tony, you were on the podcast before. It's been about a year and a half, March of 2024. We talked all about your kennel and your goals and your philosophy and all of that. And folks can go back and listen to that. The link will be down in the show notes, but we're going to take a little bit of a different perspective here this evening. But before we jump into that, can you remind our listeners who you are and what you're all about, please?
Yeah, so my name is Tony Coughlin. I founded and own Endurance Kennels. We have sprint racing Alaskan Huskies. You know, now we have our own sort of bloodline, but we do cross in, you know, new blood every now and then. And so, you know, it races anywhere from the six dog class up to the open class. And then we also give rides and tours, which is our main bread and butter throughout the entire winter.
And as my understanding, you have about 60 dogs, all Alaskans. And for folks that are listening, these are not your typical looking Iron Will or Togo looking dogs. You have the racier, sprintier looking dogs. Is that right?
Yeah, we have all sprint racing Alaskan Huskies. You know, some people might call them the Hound Cross, but we don't crossbreed any purebred dogs into our lines. That was been done a long, long time ago. And, you know, with the new DNA studies that are out, and with Dr. Hewson and her research, and we've done the Embark testing with our breeding pairs, and they all come back as Alaskan Huskies because there's enough genetic markers in those dogs to, you know, determine them as specific, you know, Alaskan village dogs.
Yeah, she does some great work. I know we've had her on the podcast a couple of times, and she has really helped out the sled dog community with all that genetic testing that she has done. And boy, she speaks all over the world about it. So I guess she's pretty renowned in that stance, don't you think?
Yeah, it helps to have a musher, you know, like her doing that genetic research, and then, you know, Dr. Reynolds too up there in Fairbanks. And, you know, it really helps us mushers a lot to show that we have researchers and peer review studies out there that are working with, you know, sled dog racing specific sled dogs.
Right. And for folks listening, you probably are already getting the gist that this is not your typical interview where we're going to talk about racing and all of that good stuff. We're going to talk a lot about educating the public about the sport of dog mushing. I know that Tony does a lot of that on social media, and we're going to jump into that in just a second. But before we do that, so Tony, I know that you're really active on social media and trying your best to educate the public out there on all things dog mushing, dog sledding, and the public perception has shifted a little bit, especially with the advent of social media. Everybody thinks that they are an expert, if you will. We get a lot of backlash, both you and I, on our Facebook pages by keyboard warriors, if you know what I mean. What is your intention with educating the folks out there, because you can only do so much, but I think you do a pretty good job with it.
Well, yeah, let's go back, you know, to the beginning. You know, we had our Facebook page going and we just kind of showed, you know, what was going on. This was way back in when I started the business back in 2009, and we were just racing. It was really hard to build an audience because you just had, you know, your friends would follow, or you know, another musher would follow, and you just share what you're doing. And back then there was no way you could really modify or like feed the algorithm, so to speak, unless you had something really important to say, or if you were a very important public figure, someone that was, you know, winning the Iditarod and whatnot. So there wasn't a lot of traffic in that Facebook area. And then we shifted over and started doing some YouTube stuff, and you put videos on there, and then Instagram came along, and you could integrate, you know, what you're doing with Facebook into Instagram. And then TikTok, I think, is what really pushed us, you know, further than we've ever gone. And TikTok just took off because it's worldwide, and it was a much younger audience, and they're taking a look and seeing what we're doing with these sled dogs, and their minds are blown. So, you know, TikTok, you know, we got up to almost 300,000 followers is where, you know, we're close to now. And then TikTok had this great monetization program and was paying their creators. So, you know, it was worth our time to do these videos and to educate. And we're just showing what we're doing. And every now and then we have a little fun, we tease. And then they stopped that program. And then all of a sudden Facebook started doing monetizing. So, you know, we got on that bandwagon. And then, so I had all the, you know, just very business-like posts and pictures of this and that, and really didn't post daily life stuff on Facebook. So I just started taking all the old videos I'd done for probably 4 years on TikTok and just started uploading them to Facebook, you know, and then it started going crazy. I think, you know, we've gone 40,000 new followers in the last 2 years, I think.
Hey, there's nothing wrong with that. And of course, if you can make a little bit of money when you're doing it, I think that that helps. It's definitely not going to make the person rich by any stretch of the imagination from these monetization programs on social media, but we're able to at least get the message out and try our best to educate the public. And I know that you do a really good job, and I see you pop up on our feeds all the time. And of course, a lot of that has to do with the algorithm and how many times we're commenting back and forth on each other and that sort of thing. But it appears to me, Tony, that your approach to this is trying to negate some of the noise, if you will, when you're making these educational type posts. And some of them are just straight out text posts. You know, it says, hey, you know, this or that equals this, you know, that I can't think of one right off the top. But what is your purpose in that? Is it to truly educate the folks that are trying to learn about the sport? Is it just kind of, you know, causing interaction? What's your purpose behind it?
A little bit of both, because, you know, we all have our own experience with sled dogs and training dogs, and none of them are wrong. So, right. You know, we have a large kennel, so we see a lot of things, you know, even much more when I look back and see when we first started, moved at this property. I only had 9 dogs because that's all I had, you know, moving from Wendigo, where we had 70 dogs there, you know, taking care of everybody and training everybody. So, you know, these thoughts pop up in my head and I'm just like, you know, that's a really strong message. And when you add that background on Facebook, it only allows you so many characters. Otherwise, you know, if we're going to elaborate, sometimes I'll elaborate, like I made a post last week, or what we look for when we're breeding sled dogs. And then you got to put a picture or a video along with that. And then these are just things, because because we get hundreds of customers per year, and these are just some of the common things that people wonder about and ask questions about, and basically, you know, trying to cater to people who are in the working dog world and not necessarily the pet world, the show world, more of the sporting dog, working dog type folks. That seems to be our larger audience. And then we have you know, people in the working dog world that really like it, because we just tell it straightforward. We don't BS, we don't beat around the bush, and people can make up their own minds, and then sometimes I'll just elaborate in the comments. So it's just an interesting to see other people's perspective. But then, yeah, you do get the people who think they know it all, and then they just go straight to insults, and then you know that they're just there to argue for whatever reason.
Yeah, and I think you do a great job of educating folks with your posts. And like you said, it's catching that little bit of time that somebody has, you have their attention, whether it is that video or that text or whatever. I think that you're really good at that. And that's why I wanted to have you on today. But my first question to you in regards to that, now that we sort of have the background leading up to this, is when you are reaching out to the general public, and they may or may not know a whole lot about our sport or our lifestyle, what is that one message that you're trying to get across to these newcomers that may be curious, that may be thinking about, maybe I should get into this for one reason or another? What is that initial message you're trying to post?
I think, you know, in regards to that, is that there's a variety of sled dogs around the planet. And if you look at every northern culture around the entire world, they all have their own niche and job related type of working dog. So it's not just all we see is, you know, Alaska, and then they see Disney movies where there's a Malamute and a Siberian, and that's all they think there are for sled dogs around the world. There's at least two dozen different types of sled dogs across every northern culture around the entire world, and people don't realize that. So it's hard to educate them, and it's very, because they see these houndy, racy looking type dogs, but they don't realize that they're not, you can't just take a greyhound and a Siberian that are pets and then all of a sudden make an Alaskan Husky. That's not how it works. They all come from very long, good bloodlines of hardworking dogs. Because and that's another thing too, Robert, is that these sled dogs keep getting faster and faster because of the selective breeding, and that we don't have a closed gene pool like purebred dogs do.
Yeah, and that's a great point, because I think, like you said, so many people are caught up in the initial story of what a sled dog is or does, and they think it's, you know, it's only on snow, and it's, you know, this perfectly in tune team that never makes any mistakes. And, you know, it's just sort of that romanticized version of our sport. And I think a lot of people get involved with that, thinking that that's what's going to be. And I don't know how many people in my 30 plus year career that, you know, have come on of handlers or help or whatever, and they get into the mix literally, and they figure out, man, I don't know if this is what I signed up for.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. There's just so, I mean, thinking about when I was first, you know, accumulating dogs and trying different things out and seeing what I liked and got lucky in some areas and unlucky in some others. It's such a huge, huge learning curve. And you really need to focus on what discipline you want to do, because there's not enough time to do it all. I mean, we all want to do it all, like off the bucket list. You know, I'd love to do a longer distance race, but I don't think my dogs can handle it. So I'd have to rent a team or lease a team. And then I want to go, you know, seal hunting in Greenland. You know, I want to go out there with those mushers and run the fan hitch and do all that fun. So I want to go, you know, moose hunting in Russia. You know, like there's just there's so many things that you can do with the sport that it there's just not enough time in the world to do it. So, you know, if you want to get involved, it's pretty easy. There's a lot of clubs and there's a lot of different disciplines, and you don't necessarily need to have snow. You know, like we have the Dryland World Championships coming up here in Wisconsin. And that's how you get into it. I mean, we did the Dryland stuff too. And then, you know, just transfers right over to snow with, you know, with the bigger teams, unless you're doing ski joring or the two dog sled. But yeah, there's a ton of different ways to get into it.
You brought up a great point, Tony. Find the discipline that you want and go after that. And I remember a very quick story. When I moved up here to Alaska, I literally brought one dog with me, a Siberian Husky, and I didn't have any other dogs at the time, and I was wanting to jump into the Alaskan mushing scene and all that. I remember going down to the feed store, Underdog Feed here, very close to us, owned by J.P. Norris, you know, kind of old school Rondi type musher. And he said, "Why don't you come out and run dogs with us?" And I said, "Yeah, let's do it." And I went over there, and he would train in the middle of the night after the store closed and all that. And I remember sitting down with him one day, and he said, "So what do you want to do with your mushing up here in Alaska?" And I said, "Well, I don't know, but I don't think I want to run sprint dogs." And he says, "Well, then you are in the wrong place to be working with us. You need to go, you know, go talk to whomever," right? And I've been mushing for many years up to that point, but it really kind of hit home. Like, yeah, I would love to work with these guys who've been doing this forever. You know, their lines go way back to the 30s with Earl and Natalie Norris and all that. But I quickly realized I was in the wrong spot to be doing what I do. And I think that's a key message to get across. Isn't that right?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, we used to train for the dry land and we tried to do some of the rig stuff, but I just didn't have the dogs I wanted or that I had previously. And then training for dry land is really tough if you want to race on snow, because cutting the mileage and increasing the speed in October, it just screwed up our whole winter program. We needed to be at home, you know, doing 10-mile runs, you know, at a slower pace at the end of October, not doing these, you know, 20-mile-an-hour, you know, 2-mile runs. It just threw everything off. And then, but it, you know, if you're just doing up to 6-dog class here in the Midwest, it's fine, because you don't really need to run your team more than 7 miles if you're racing that 6-dog class, because I don't think any of the races are longer than 6 miles around here, at least. I know when you get up into Canada and they're doing the mass starts, though, you know, the races are probably much longer than that. But yeah, it's tough. So, you know, I was at a point where I was going to be like, okay, maybe we should just have dry land specific dogs and then snow specific dogs. And that's just, you just need too many dogs for that.
And you were talking off air before we started recording, is even in your neck of the woods, which has been notorious for snow for so many years, you have no idea what's happening. I know last year, 2024, you guys had hardly any snow. And even in 2025, it was a really low snow year as well. I don't know if that's all climate change or what, but man, it's tough to train for when you don't know what's going to happen in January and February, right?
Yeah, 2 years ago, we had, you know, those, our 5-year, 4 and 5-year olds were just ripping. And I was so bummed because every single sled race in the Midwest was canceled. We had rides from the middle of January, right after Super Bowl Sunday to Valentine's Day. And that was it. Mm. We missed our cream of the crop, which is, you know, the Christmas, New Year's. When all the kids are out of school, that's when we get the most amount of business. And so we're usually, you know, running the sleds from mid-December to late March, early April. And that didn't happen that year. And then last year we were okay with snow, but the Twin Cities didn't have hardly any snow at all. So people in the Twin Cities, when they don't have snow, they think the whole state of Minnesota doesn't have snow. But once you get Duluth and further north, there was, you know, normal amounts of snow.
Right. Yeah. And for folks that are listening that may not be familiar, if you're missing 2 years of key training, especially with young dogs, that can really throw them off for their racing career. Don't you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that prime age that we have seen for our adult dogs is 2 to 6, and then it all depends on the dog. You know, they can still run, some of them can still run fairly fast at 7 years old, but they're having that pressure of having to run really fast with those 3-year-old dogs who are just full of it, you know, full of go.
Yeah, having to play catch up if they've missed that first couple of years. I guess in human terms, that would be like starting the third grade and just skipping kindergarten, first and second, just kind of just jumping into the fire.
Yeah, you see it with human athletes all the time. You know, some of these Olympians are on their third and fourth Olympiad, or like Michael Phelps, how long was his career? And you know, you can miss a year or two with humans, but if you miss a year, 2 years with sled dogs, I mean, that's half their career.
So a couple of questions about this social media prowess that you have before we jump into some more general type questions. I guess my first one is, what is the primary question that people are asking you when they're reaching out to you for advice or for some dialogue back and forth? What are they trying to get out of you? What is the question that is most prevalent in your social media?
I think even with customers, you know, it's what are those dogs? Like, why aren't you using, you know, Siberians and Malamutes? And we've answered this question over and over and over and oh, I don't know how many times. And sometimes I just can't even answer it because it's so repetitive. And it's, we built up a community that will actually show and explain it for us. So a lot of our top followers and our fans, just they'll just take care of it for me. I don't even have to ask them. And then we've also pinned a couple posts on top of our page to show them the variety of the Alaskan Husky, that study that Houston did, I think it was maybe 10 years ago, or back in 2012, I can't remember. So yeah, so that's one of the common questions we get from people that don't understand the worldwide of sled dogs and the variety of dogs, and especially even just the variety of racing dogs, the Iditarod Alaskan Husky, the middle distance Alaskan Husky, and the sprint racing Alaskan Husky. They're all different, but have very similar bloodlines. And then from the working dog folks, they get a lot of the questions they ask are about feeding and the hydration and the timing of the feeding of the dogs, which is, you know, some know, some don't. You know, the dog houses, why do you build it this way? And then so many people ask about the tie-outs and the stakeouts, and I don't even give them that information because I'm afraid that if it gets into the wrong hands, it could be abused, because if they don't do it right with trial and error, the way that, you know, it's evolved here and at previous kennels that I've been with, it's not going to work for them. Like, everything has to be set up just right. And I just don't have time to field those questions, or nor do I want to give that out to some random Joe, you know, Schmo from, you know, Illinois or Alabama or Florida, wherever they're from.
So the next question is how or what do you want to say to the naysayers out there that are following your page and either very argumentative, or they're trolling you, or you know the deal. What would you like to say to those folks that you have to interact with positive or negative on your pages all the time?
You know, they have to understand what we're working with here. We're working with a pack of dogs. So you have pack mentality. It's not working with one dog or two dogs that you have in your house. So the whole thing just elevates significantly. And you know, they want the dogs to be off leash, and they want them to be fenced in, and they want them to go to doggy daycare and do blah, blah, blah. Well, that doesn't work. They're working dogs. You can't leave food out for them. You can't leave out water for them, because then they're not going to be able to work. So, you know, if they would just listen and understand and just go through and watch our videos, because we've every question that comes through that are new, we've already talked about this multiple times, and then some of them are just they just want to argue. So
you either
just let it go, or if they want to argue, sometimes I'll just I have nothing to do, so I'll just mess with them and have fun, you know, have a little bit of entertainment for myself, and then they get mad and I'll just block you.
Yes, the old block feature is a good one for sure. You know, you're preaching to the choir here. I hear this all the time in our dog training business. Of course, we're working primarily with, you know, just the average pet dog, the golden retriever, German Shepherd, Labrador, or whatever. And it's sometimes so difficult just to get the pet owner to understand how important routine is, how important training is. Because the world of dog ownership, not specifically to working dogs, but the world of dog ownership has considerably been changed over the last decade or two. I'm sure you would agree with that.
Yeah. You guys have the dog training business, so you're working on you're doing that one-on-one stuff, and you know, as much as people hate Cesar Millan, you know, he does have a formula down. I don't agree with everything he says, but exercise is so important. And then, you know, getting that dog to outlet, because they need to move and they need to see stuff. They need that exercise. And then working with a hungry dog during training is so you're going to get so much better results when you do that stuff. And if people would just realize these are the basic things, and that their dogs are developing mental issues because they're not getting enough stimulus, you know, like the house dogs, sometimes we can't do anything in the summer, so I'll take the house dogs and just take them to do chores, you know, run to the grocery store, or, you know, run to Menards and or town to do errands, sorry. That wears them out, you know. It's better for them than just sitting in a crate or sitting at home not doing anything.
Yeah, it's a tough hoe to haul for sure, and education is key. Of course, on our Mushing magazine page, we do our best to educate folks about you know, media and fandom and, you know, all that other stuff. And people are constantly arguing with us, saying, you know, we don't want it that way. We want to be reclusive. We want to be independent. We don't want to talk to the media, you know, all of these things. But on the other hand, they're constantly asking for sponsors, and it's not necessarily a give and take, is it? You kind of got to play the game a little bit, don't you?
You have to, like, you can't, you know, I was a race director for the largest inline marathon in United States. It's now the largest point to point in the world. And as an athlete myself, you know, looking for sponsors, you have to get out there and do stuff for free. You have to get out and educate, because people aren't going to come and find you and then just give you money and have no entitlements from that donation whatsoever. So you're a walking salesperson. You're also a walking salesperson for your sport. So, you know, that if people want to go back and hide in the shadows, then they really shouldn't complain too much that they're not getting what they want. And like, you have to be out into the public. You have to be, you know, educating, because you want they want the sport to grow, but yet they don't want to do anything about it. They want more races, but they don't want to help out. They don't want to put on a race. So, like, I don't understand that mindset either, because it doesn't work.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head, and that was the exact exchange that we were going back and forth on the other day on our Facebook page. And that's one of the main reasons I wanted to have you on, because, as you said, you have to figure out a way to give back, and sort of the thesis of this entire episode is about educating the public, whether they are the participating public in our sport or in our lifestyle, or the public that is consuming our sport, whether it be through social media or going to races or whatever. So before I jump into sort of these regular questions, Tony, do you have anything else you want to mention about this sort of main idea of this episode, or can we move on?
You know, I think You know, one tip for some of the mushers out there, if they want, you know, they want to be more active on social media, it doesn't have to be perfect, because, you know, all you need to do is compare yourself to who you were yesterday. So just try to be a little bit better. There's always going to be a better musher. There's always going to be a better sled dog. There's always going to be a better race. It's just like that. That's how life is. So, you know, just share what you're doing from a day-to-day perspective, and people will learn from that, because we don't do the same thing that Buddy and Terry do, and we don't do the same thing that, you know, Nick Pettit and the Iditarod mushers do. But we can learn from each other. You know, it's like, oh, that's really interesting. I want to try that, just to integrate that in my kennel just a little bit and see how it works, or you know, try this a little bit different, and just put your stuff out there. Otherwise, you know, if you don't want to, then really you have no say in how things develop and how things evolve.
I couldn't have said it better. I appreciate that. So let's jump into some of these questions, and they can be a little bit of a rapid fire, if you will. But the first one up, Tony, is what is your favorite race and why?
Oh man, I would say it's a toss-up between the Fur-Rondi and the Onak. And the Fur-Rondi for the festival and the crowds there in Anchorage, it's really fun to watch the coverage that Kale puts out there. And then the North American for just the super high track speed and the longer the additional 5 miles that they got to do on the last day really tests your dog team, especially if you've had to cut your team down.
Yeah, and I would agree with the Fur-Rondi. I've been down there several times since we've been up here, and it truly is that festival atmosphere. They've got the carnival rides and the mustache and beard contest and the true fur rendezvous where they're trading furs and all of that. It's definitely harkening back to kind of old school mushing for sure. So the next one is you have done some racing in your time. I know that you haven't done it much in the last couple of years, but can you share a quick story about one of your races? Tell us what that race was and a little bit about it.
Yeah, so I remember we went out to Idaho, and there was a newer open class race that we traveled out there for, and I had prepped the team for that race, and I think it was at the end of January, and there was mushers coming from everywhere. I think my friend Dave Turner was there from Washington State, and then Hardums came down from Alberta, and then Alex Crittenden, and then they were training some young streeper dogs there. But it was really interesting, the weather. Well, I almost lost my half of my dog team in North Dakota, so
My
we
goodness.
stopped the drop, and I just let a few dogs loose, and we were on some back dirt road off the freeway where I could let the dogs loose, and so they could stretch their legs and do whatnot. And then two of them decided to, hey, let's go for a run, and they took off and had to quick load up the rest of the dogs that were dropped down and then go chase them down. So they did a good 5 mile run in the middle of North Dakota. But then once we got into Montana, I think we were, I can't remember, by Bozeman or Billings, I can't remember. The weather just cranked up. There must have been a Chinook that came through, and it was 65 degrees, and I was worried about the dogs overheating. We got down to Ashton and did the pre-race meeting, and they had to move the course up into the mountains because 2 days before they had straight line winds, 60 mile an hour winds. And it wiped out the entire dog trail. So we had to go a little bit higher up into the mountains, and then it snowed probably 6 inches on Saturday and Sunday during the race. And we had, I think we had a six dog class that was around 8 miles or so, and then an open class that was, I think, it was a little bit longer. It was 18 miles versus the 16 that it was supposed to be. So, but yeah, that was really interesting to have those that race course change, and then be up a little bit higher elevation and snow falling, and it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, you can't always train for every race. Sometimes you just kind of go roll with the punches for sure. Was that the dog derby, the American Dog Derby, I believe it's called?
No, it was put on by an old open class musher. I can't remember the name of the race, but it might have only happened for 1 or 2 years.
Okay.
And it was just like 2 or 3 weeks before stage stop.
All right, next question is, who do you think is or was the most influential dog driver or mushing in the sport?
Oh man, that's a tough question. I mean, how do you put all that weight on somebody's shoulders? I think, like I said before, there's so much that we can learn from everyone who wants to put that information out there. There might be the best musher in the world, and we don't even really know about them because they wanna do their own thing. Man, I don't know if I can answer that question, Robert.
They
That's
hold the cards close to the vest, if you will. Well, let's change it up a little bit. Who has been maybe one of your mentors, or who did you go to seek out advice from? Who really gave you that one nugget that really sticks with you?
Well, I mean, I'm pretty biased, but Deb and Steve Cervasek have become, Steve passed away about a year and a half ago, and we were best friends, and sometimes we were even at each other's throats a few times, I remember, but they became family,
Right.
and I learned a lot from those guys. Not everything, and they learned some stuff from me too, because I mean, I still talk to Deb at least once a week, sometimes even more. And sometimes most of the time we don't even talk about sled dogs or dog mushing. And she's getting into the Chukotka dogs, the original Siberian dogs, and importing them from Russia. So she's diving into that world now that she's done with, the racing scene, and still making harnesses and collars and stuff. But we can just pick up the phone and have an hour conversation in no time. So yeah, people that you really get along with, and people that are accept you into their home, and vice versa. And it's tough to find these days, the people that want to talk on the phone and, put their smartphones down, stop looking at Google and social media, and really want to talk to someone. So the social gatherings in the mushing community are really important too. Having just, races or club events, people to pick each other's brains and say why are you using that equipment that way, or why you hooking up to your bike that way, or why you hook up to the sled this way. And it's such a good community to learn, new things, new techniques, new equipment, and pick each other's brains.
Yeah, I agree. And I think a lot of that is sort of falling by the wayside. And I know we were talking about that on one of our posts the other day. Is gone are the days where, we had pre and post race banquets and, bonfires and all that sort of stuff. Nowadays, so many people are just so ready to load their dogs up in the truck and either head down to the next race or head home or whatever. The community is shrinking a little bit. I'm sure you would agree with that as well.
Yeah, it is. It's tough. It's tough to have this big kennel. I mean, I only have handlers here in the wintertime when I can afford to pay them. And so, the whole summer I'm taking care of all these dogs by myself, and other mushers have done that too. But sometimes there's a partner or a spouse, and they can share some of that workload, but it's the only thing I do. I mean, it's a lifestyle, and I was able to make it my profession back in 2016 and do it full time, just focusing on the dogs. And I think that really shows in your program when you can put full effort into your kennel and be there and doing chores and improvements and stuff like that. You learn a lot more than just working 9 to 5, come home, feeding dogs, training. When you're immersed into it full time, well, it's more than full time. It's probably double time if you add up all the hours. But yeah, it's definitely shrinking. But like you said, with the mentors, it's good to have a pocket full, because if your go-to mentors can't answer the question, they'll say, "Hey, I know who knows that answer, or who you can call." So call them and talk to them. But you really need a handful of good, experienced mushers in your back pocket that are willing to talk to you, because, like you said, not everybody wants to talk and share and do whatever. And I remember some mushers, some very old time mushers that, I kind of got the point after the second time you call them. They're just like, they pick up the phone and they say, "What do you want?" It's like,
Right.
okay, sorry for bothering you.
We'll move on. We'll move on and figure out if we could talk to somebody else. Yeah, I agree. Have those much those mentors on I guess the proverbial speed dial. I don't think even people even do that anymore. But yeah, great advice for sure. Okay, let's circle back to the original question, Tony, and that is, what is your most humbling experience in the sport of dog mushroom?
Well, Robert, I hate to give you this general answer, but it's the dogs. The
Okay.
dogs always keep you humble, and they will always challenge you and test your boundaries, but yet give you what you ask for them. So, if it wasn't for the dogs, we obviously wouldn't do it, but they keep you in check, and you have to keep them in check too. So, developing that good trust relationship where you're not going to push them too far or past their limits, or and developing the sensitivity that you need with every single dog and their individual cares. And oh, that dog's going to be done by mile 35. I know I need to load it in the sled, or I'm going to leave it at the checkpoint. So, like, the dogs really keep you humble. I don't think there's any real one experience that I can think of, out on the trail. But I think, raising puppies is a really tough thing too, and that brings you right down to earth and shows you either how they can really thrive and survive and be tough and strong, but yet they're so fragile, and their life can end pretty quick if something goes wrong. So that's a really tough spot. So a lot of mushers will buy adult dogs and don't want to do the breeding aspect, but if you do, it's pretty tough.
Yeah, it is. And that's one of the things I try to push to when I'm teaching at the universities, is just sort of that whole life cycle of things, whether it be training or husbandry or education or whatever. Because most people, like we talked about earlier, most people, their relationship with dogs is just the family house dog. And they see that from puppyhood grow up to be a 12-year-old dog, and then they pass on, and then it's over. But with us, we're dealing with it literally life and death over and over and over and over again. That
Yeah.
is a humbling experience, isn't it?
Yeah. 2 years ago, we had an aging kennel, and no, it was 3 years ago, I think. We lost 11 dogs just from normal age and cancer and whatnot. And it was so hard on me, because every single one of them I had raised from puppies. Like they wouldn't exist if it wasn't for me. And to lose them and have, you know, remember their lives and their personality, you know, to lose 11 in 1 year was just like, oh man, like I don't know how I can do this anymore. Like
yeah,
I just it's
it's a gut
tough.
punch. Yeah, it's a gut punch for sure. And you know, that's as they say, that's the reason we do this, so we can be a part of these dogs' lives for sure.
Sure.
So Tony, you were talking to me before air about a couple of new litters of puppies you have on the ground there. What are the plans for these guys? If you're thinking into the future in the next 4 or 5 years from now, where do you see this group of dogs?
Well, definitely, you know, they're already showing their yearlings now. They're already showing super athleticism. They're running just as fast as their parents are, free running, which usually we see them peak free running at 3 to 4 years old, top speed. So I'm really excited to see what they're going to do when we put some stress and we put some miles on them. But they're absolutely 10 dog, 10 mile easy. And then hopefully, you know, beyond that, we can do the 20 to 25 mile distances that we would need to do in February or March.
Well, hey, we were talking earlier about the Fur Rondi. I guess that fits right into that game plan with 3 or 4 runs of 25. You could do a Fur Rondi with something like that, right?
Well, we're hoping, you know, we just need a couple good heavy snow seasons here where we get a ton of business, so I can put that, you know, that capital into, you know, a trailer and a truck that I can take the dogs to Alaska and then be gone, you know, because you really do need to be up there training for that and racing for 2.5 months if you're going to do, you know, the Fur Rondi and the North American.
Right. Well, it'd be interesting to have you up here and definitely hang out with you when you do get here. So with that, Tony, tell us how folks can follow you. We talked all about you being active on social media. Where are you the most active, and where can people reach out and ask questions?
Yeah, right now we're the most active on Facebook, TikTok, and Instagram, and then we do shorts on YouTube too, if there's any YouTube folks out there. And then they can find us at endurancekennels.com.
And we'll put all the links there in the show notes. Again, Tony Coughlin from Endurance Kennels up in Duluth, Minnesota. It's fun to catch up with you again, and we'll talk again soon, okay?
Thanks, Robert. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. On behalf of my guest today, this is Robert for Mushing. We will see you guys next time. Goodbye.
Are you a fan of the great outdoors? Do you enjoy the thrill of speed and adventure? Then listen up. Introducing Mushing, your ultimate guide to the exciting world of dog-powered sports and mushing. Whether you're a seasoned musher or just starting out, Mushing has got you covered. Get ready to immerse yourself in captivating stories of incredible sled dog races, expert training tips from seasoned professionals, and gear reviews to help you make the right choices for your team. From the breathtaking landscapes of Alaska to the snowy trails of Scandinavia, Mushing takes you on a thrilling journey through the world of dog-powered sports. Don't miss out on the latest issue, packed with exclusive interviews with top mushers, in-depth articles on sled dog nutrition, and stunning photography that will transport you to the heart of the action. So whether you're dreaming of competing in the Iditarod or simply want to learn more about this incredible sport, Mushing is your go-to resource. Subscribe now and get ready to unleash your passion for mushing. Visit our website at mushing.com or find us on your favorite podcast platform. Mushing, where the spirit of adventure meets the power of the pack.